Clayton. Sean Clayton.
Hey, Mom! I'm done with my segment!
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Coors Light. Made to chill.
Time to talk some football with the Professor John Clayton, as we do every day here with Bob, Dave, and Moore. Hello, John.
Hello. How are you?
We're good. We were playing some cuts earlier from Bruce Irvin in his little his Zoom meeting with the media, and he sounds like he's a guy who's ready to take on the role of being a mentor to some of the young guys on this squad. Is he a guy you look at and say, man, he's got that kind of cachet, he's got that respect, and more importantly, he's got the technique that he can pass along to some of these younger guys?
Yeah, I do. I think that you can look at, you know, because as good as he was in his years here in Seattle, I mean, he ended up even playing better, as he said, when he went to the other teams. And so much of that is that, you know, I think the father figure of Ken Norton Jr., because, I mean, look at what Ken Norton Jr. did when he was a linebacker coach. I mean, basically, you know, raised Bobby Wagner, K.J. Wright, and Bruce Irvin, and they all have had great careers. And you can see that. You know, that's now carried through in the fact that now all three are together with Ken Norton as a defensive coordinator. But I thought the one thing that was kind of interesting and kind of challenging, because they ask him flat out, it's like, okay, so what are you going to play? It's like, well, I'm going to be a strong side linebacker, and I'm going to play defensive end on third down. And so that's kind of interesting, because now does that mean that if they move K.J. Wright over to Irvin's the strong side, does that mean that Irvin is competing against him, or is he going to keep K.J. on the weak side and take the two young guys, Cody Barton and Jordan Brooks, and put them on the strong side? My read is, you know, the strong side competition is going to end up being both Brooks going up against Cody Barton, but it's going to be interesting to see that you know, who's going to be the starting strong side.
Hey, John, sorry I cut out for a little bit there, but I'm curious if any of the things that this Greco guy has said, another article coming out today, make you feel any, I don't know, more secure that that possibly Dunbar is able to play for the Seahawks this year?
I would think so. I mean, my read on it is that if you are going to have the victims say that they're not victims, and that's what Greco has and the attorney for DeAndre Baker has, you know, both have affidavits from the four victims and the other witnesses that pretty much say what they didn't do. And if that's the case, now again, Baker's going to be a little bit different, because I don't know exactly what's in there, but Greco has come out strong and said that you know, the five people who, you know, put his name in said he didn't do anything. And if you have no victim with him and you have no incident, then I can't see there's going to be, you know, too much of a case.
Yeah, I'm just going through this story, though, John. So many things don't add up. Did he tell you in that interview, his attorney, that the witnesses were scam artists?
No, he did not say that.
Oh, he didn't say that. Okay.
Well, not at least on my interview. I mean, you know, I tried to be as specific as I can and as professional as I can. And I said, well, who are these people? I mean, are these people that, you know, have had, you know, bad pasts, or, you know, have rap sheets and things like that? And he, you know, he didn't, it wasn't like, I mean, he was such a good interview. He didn't decline to say anything, but he stayed out of that. He says, I'm not going to characterize, you know, the individuals and all that. I wasn't there and I can't characterize them. And so that was pretty much what he said. So he didn't call them scam artists. I know that, you know, the idea that came, this is probably more from the prosecutor, and the prosecutor on Friday saying, well, why did they change their story? And so were they, trying to do that? I know in the back when they were going back and forth, you know, one of the things that he did say, it's like, well, I mean, and this is on the court case, is that, you know, I don't know if there was an effort there to try to fleece, or, you know, try to take money away, all that different stuff. You know, the motives of the change of the testimony, I can't read. I don't know. A lot of those things aren't there. So, you know, that's going now for the police and the prosecutor to sort out.
So we touched on this yesterday, and by the way, a reminder for the listeners out there, you guys can text in any questions you've got for John. Text them into 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. We'll try to get to your questions before we let him go. But we touched on this yesterday, John, with the idea that the league has punished players that have not been convicted of anything, where there was no case. Ben Roethlisberger, he suffered a suspension, and we talked about Jaron Reed. So something took place here. Whether it goes to court or not, something happened, and I don't think there's any debate as to whether Baker and Dunbar were there. Now, what their role was is completely cloudy. Could you see the league punishing them for some sort of conduct detrimental or whatever term they want to throw on it, or how do you see it playing out?
Not if the charges are dropped. I can't see that happening whatsoever. Okay, so were they gambling? You would presume maybe they were. I mean, you got dice and all that stuff. I know that when asked specifically, I asked Michael Grieco, what about the 2 days before when the witnesses alleged that they lost $70,000, both Baker and Dunbar, and he says that's just not true. Now, again, he wasn't saying it for Baker, but he was saying it for Dunbar. He says that's just not true whatsoever. But you know, if this thing is dropped, I mean, hey, say what you want. It's like it may not be good to roll dice, but it's legal. You can't do anything against that. You know, gambling to that degree is legal. It may not be the wisest thing to do, but you can do that. And so, if you have no victims. And you have no gun thing against you, and it looks like, you know, the one thing that they didn't do is put any gun charge on Dunbar. It was, you know, obviously it was armed robbery, but they're not claiming that he had the gun. And so I think that if that's going to be the case, you just got to drop it, and the league can't do anything.
Hey, John, there's a quote from Ryan Fitzpatrick saying he's going to be Tua Tagovailoa's biggest cheerleader. But I want to play. You know, I think a lot of times you get these older quarterbacks, like, you know, same thing with Aaron Rodgers, and a lot of people think, oh, well, he's going to take this kid under his arm. Well, let's not forget that they're still competitors, man. And I think we sometimes overestimate how much, you know, that happens and whether it happens at all. I mean, I think there's a lot of times where some of these guys get that, you know, a young guy coming in and like, hey, I'm fighting for my NFL life right now.
Well, and you can appreciate this more than anybody else because, you know what happened with the 1983 draft and all the quarterbacks taken then. And I would venture to say that each one of them, even when they were in the process of retiring, wanted to go that one or two extra years. You know, because, you know, John Elway, I'm sure, you know, even after the two Super Bowls, probably wanted to play one more year. I mean, I'd go back to Troy Aikman. You know, a lot of these quarterbacks that, you know, play for 14, 15, 16 years don't like to give it up. You know, they love the game of football. They don't want to give up the game of football. And so, even Kurt Warner just recently, about a year ago, started about thinking about coming out of retirement. So it's hard for them to give up the game. And you can see, even though certainly Ryan Fitzpatrick is not in the category of any of those Hall of Fame quarterbacks, you know, he's been in the game long enough and loves it long enough. I don't think that you look at this as saying that he's going to be, you know, against Tua. But again, it's like he also realizes Tua's coming in with no off-season program. He, you know, may or may not have preseason games. And so Ryan, you know, has to gear himself up to start the season until Tua gets ready. And when Tua's ready, then, you know, Fitzpatrick's, he sits.
John, I like this question from the 425. What happens with Ben Burke-Kirvin now with all these other linebackers on the Seahawks?
I mean, he'll, you know, he still has the possibility of, I mean, you know, he'll be special teams. That's one thing that's there for sure. I'm sure he'll do some more work in the middle, at middle linebacker, you know, but will he get the playing time? I mean, it's going to be pushed back because, you know, if indeed Irvin is going to do a little bit at the strong side and you've got now, one more linebacker added in the first round, you know, it's pretty much special teams or nothing. And that's why, you know, I still think that, there's a good enough spot for him to make the team. You know, I worry about Shaquem Griffin. I think that's going to be really tough because look at the numbers that are against him. But the one thing I think you can see from this draft and what they've done this offseason, they want extra competition. You know, that's why instead of two offensive linemen, they brought in four. You know, they've got competition now at the linebacker spot. They've got competition at the Leo. You know, they've got competition in the secondary. I think that both John Snyder and Pete Carroll want to make this as competitive as possible so they can try to be as good as possible.
710-710 is the Busy Hard Seltzer text line. If you've got questions for the professor, John, this one comes from 208. Professor, do you think with all the web-based training and meetings going on that younger coaches in the NFL have an advantage?
Not necessarily. I think it's the experienced coaches that have, you know, the ones that have been together, because the younger coaches are still learning on the job. You know, I guess, you know, if you're a guy that has been doing well for 3-4 years, then you're okay. But I think the younger coaches have to kind of struggle with this because, you know, they haven't experienced it. That's why, for example, you know, the coaches like Pete Carroll and Ron Rivera and, you know, Bill Belichick and Andy Reid, they've been through this. You know, they at least in 2011, you know, there was the lockout, so they've been through this while all the other guys didn't. And sure, it may help to have the technology advantage of, you know, Zoom and, you know, all the different things like that to communicate, but hey, coaching is done on the field, and this is not being done on the field. So I think the advantages still go to the veteran coaches because, you know, they've been through more and they know more what to do and they know how to adjust.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, John. That's something that I think people think because of the technology part of it. But you're right. I mean, it all happens on the field. The other thing, too, is that some of these older coaches, they just have the tech guy come over from whatever team and set them up so that they can do Zoom and things like that, right?
Oh, no question. I think that, you know, because again, it's nice to have the technology and, you know, it's fortunate that the technology is there now where it wasn't there in 2011. And so you can catch up a little bit. But again, this game is taught on the field, not in the, not on TV.
Hey, John, if there's a cap casualty with the Seahawks, say they sign Everson Griffin or Clowney or someone else, who do you think's the most likely candidate to go first? Would it be KJ, Hollister, McDougald, or someone else?
I think you start to look at, depending on the position, because whatever position comes in is probably going to knock a position out. So what I would look at first would be, you know, three of the four, you know, guys who were the restricted free agents, because, you know, they're each at 2.133, with the exception of Hollister, who is at 3.259. And, you know, so I think they'll be the first. Like, for example, if they bring in, you know, Everson Griffin or they bring in Clowney, I think it's going to be tough on Brandon Jackson. So, you know, as much as they like him. So I think they'll be the first casualties. And then depending on what happens, then you'd look at, you know, two guys that you'd like to have on your team. But, you know, if depending on how much they need, it could come down to KJ Wright. It could come down to Bradley McDougald. So, you know, but again, I think the idea is you don't want to do that. I mean, you don't want to lose starting talent. I mean, you're trying to win, and you're trying to win as best as possible. So, you know, but I think that, you know, the ones, because when they, if they bring in a veteran defensive tackle to play the run stopper, you know, that could, you know, sacrifice one or two of the guys. But they're at the stage right now, believe it or not, you know, you bring in one, you're losing one, and there's still two or three spots that they're going to address. They got the deal done with Geno Smith. They need that run stopping defensive tackle. They may go for a veteran running back, and you know, I'd say the one wide receiver, if he becomes free, would be Josh Gordon. You know, if Josh Gordon's going to come back, so those would be some of the spots that I think they look at. And of course, as we talk about all the time, defensive end.
Hey, John, what do you make of this story with LeBron James saying, you know, when they had that lockout in 2011 in the NBA, he started training to play football, and he's got a framed contract offer from Jerry Jones in his house, and he had an offer for the Cowboys. I mean, this is obviously a tremendous, one of the greatest to ever play basketball, but never played a lick of college football, and the idea that he play in the NFL seems a little far-fetched.
Not necessarily, because I remember back in 2011, LeBron James tweeted me and asked me if he thinks that that I thought if he could play football, and I said absolutely. I says, you know, because one, he's a great athlete. Two, you know, that's you can look back at in history and see the guys who are basketball players making the transition to tight end. You know, Antonio Gates. I mean, you watch George Fant. Certainly Sam Clancy out here, because I remember covering Sam Clancy when he was a basketball player at Pitt. And I was the beat writer for the Pitt basketball team, you know, for the Pittsburgh Press. And so, yeah, I think that you can do that. And I think that, you know, as an athlete, you know, because again, you're talking about one of the great athletes ever. Just because he's that tall doesn't mean that he necessarily can not do it. So, I mean, I was flattered that he just tweeted me and asked me if I thought he could, and I said I thought he could. And what I didn't realize is that he was actually doing the training and all that to prepare himself for football. That one I did not know, but, I mean, he tweeted me, so I guess I got a little bit of insight on that.
John, what do you think about Bruce Irvin? What do you expect from him this year? He feels like one of those guys that, you know, I was talking about how Bruce Smith, late in his career, in his late 30s and 40 years old, had 29 sacks in 4 years when he was, I don't know, it just Bruce Irvin seems like he keeps, takes good care of himself, and that he can be one of those guys, even though he's going to turn 33 here, that it can still be very productive. He had 8.5 sacks, which is his career high last year.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it, he can do a good job. I don't doubt that, because again, it's like, you know, in every stop that he's made, he's done well, whether it's a little bit of the 3-4 defense that he experienced last year, whether it's, you know, what he did with Oakland and all those different things. And, you know, again, the one thing is he gives you speed. I mean, he came into the league with great speed. He still has that speed. And now he's got, you match up with the fact that he's got all this experience to go with the speed. You know, I still think he can do a good job. And now the question is, you know, how much does he do it at defensive end? How much does he do it at linebacker? And, you know, is he going to be a starter? Is he going to be a role player? You know, whatever it's going to be. But I think he can do very well.
Hey, John, do you have any more details on Washington wide receiver Cody Latimer, charged with second-degree assault? There were shots in his apartment, allegations of sexual assault of his 4-year-old son at a poker game. Can you make heads or tails of anything that's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds bad, because it did seem as though, although again these are accusations that haven't been substantiated yet, but you know, the two shots were fired, and so you can't take that back. And so it's like, okay, so now you have to determine, did Latimer take those shots and have the gun? Because, you know, I don't know about the sexual part of it or the domestic part of it, but you know, something happened, you know, in this case it was a card game, not a dice game, and he got mad about something allegedly, and then did that. So I think right now, I mean, he's in trouble. I think that you know, the fact that the gun had two bullets fired, and if he has the prints on it and everything else, I think it could be very bad for him.
Hey, John, text questions coming in. One just off the football topic, 28. John, have you been binge watched anything while you've been staying at home?
No, because I've been working so much on the database, because you know, this is such an opportune time to get the database in as good a shape as possible for the salary cap and how teams were built and, you know, the base salaries of everybody and all that. And also trying to get the ages, because I have to get the ages, date of birth of all the players, so I can keep a rolling account of all that. So my binge watching has been right in front of the computer trying to update my salary cap and how they were built databases.
When's the last time? I know we can't do it now. When's the last time you went to the movies, John?
I think it was like 3 years ago, something like that. Maybe,
oh, man,
yeah, 3 years. It was one of those things where I got a pass, and you know, my Pat loves going to the movies, and but it was probably 3 years ago, and it was probably some sports movie that I got a free preview pass to with Pat. I think it may have been draft day. You know, it may have been draft day. That might have been the last one that I've been to see.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That was probably
that was fun. I enjoyed that movie, John.
I did, too. Yeah. I mean, it was great to see how messed up the Browns ownership was.
Yeah. True to life. Okay,
Frank Langella is the Browns owner.
Oh, that's right. NFL.com, John, they came out with the most underappreciated player for each team, and Buda Baker for Arizona and Quandre Diggs for Seattle. Do you like those choices?
I like them a lot, yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's the fact that they're both safeties, but, you know, when you look at Buda Baker, I mean, you know, he goes from special teams Pro Bowler to the Pro Bowl, and he's got such good range and such hitting ability and all that. And what you like about Diggs is, even though, you know, he's playing the Earl Thomas spot and he's not Earl Thomas, he shows some of the signs and reminds you of some of the things that Earl did. I mean, whether it's coming up and having good instincts and trying to go for the ball, whether it's trying to make the big hit, whether it's showing his range. You know, I think that's a great one, because, again, you know, what you're looking at is that you pick him up for a fifth-round pick. He's good enough that he's getting votes to go to the Pro Bowl, because he was a Pro Bowl alternate for 2 years. I think that's the perfect one for this team.
John, Bill Barnwell ranked the Seahawks offseason 26th in the league. What do you think of that?
It's too low. I think that when you look at it, now, I don't know if he did this, you know, with the idea that Quentin Dunbar is not going to be with the team or is going to have problems and all that. I mean, you know, you still look that they were able to get, you know, two possible starters on the offensive line. They were able to get a speed third receiver in Philip Dorsett. You know, they were able to make the deal, which I think kind of put the offseason over the top, in Quentin Dunbar. Is it going to make the top 10? No. I mean, because again, it had Jadeveon Clowney come back, then that might put it over the top 10. And so I think the question mark, they're not getting Clowney and the question mark, but again, they got four pass rush possibilities. I think that's good. You know, they still can add, you know, a veteran running back, a run stopping defensive tackle. Maybe they can get Gordon back. So no, I'd put it probably in that, 13 to 14 range, not 26.
John, we appreciate it. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good.
There you go, the Professor John Clayton with us every day. If you missed any of today's cold, hard facts, brought to you by Coors Light, made to chill, just download the podcast at 710sports.com. Meanwhile, Pete Carroll admitted that sometimes he can be a little too optimistic on players in the latest episode of his Flying Coach podcast. We'll hear what he had to say coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
A reminder, you've got radios in your homes. If you've got a smart speaker, whether it's Alexa, Google, whatever it is, just tell it to play 710 ESPN Seattle or 710 AM, and boom, you got a radio right there in your home. Or you can download the 710 Sports app. It's powered by Dubin Law Group. It's free, so there you go. Ready to go. Coming up at the top of the hour, El Hombre. Michael Bradley will be joining us, as he does every Tuesday at 5 o'clock. But Pete Carroll has got his Flying Coach podcast that he's been doing in the offseason here, and all kinds of good things there. Cut number eight, interesting. Pete Carroll says his optimism, which we all joke about it and people think it's an act and all that good stuff, can cause him to falter at times with player evaluation.
I'm a real victim to that now. I'm such an optimist that I kind of think that, you know, I see something that really excites me about a guy, and I want to, you know, I don't have to see like him play great all the time. If I can see enough stuff, then I think I can tap into it. And I'm a little bit of a victim of that, you know, in recruiting and all that, because I am maybe too optimistic about that. Basically, they pretty much are what they are, and then you develop them, you know, and you try to add too. But I falter there.
What do you think of that? I mean, you could point to examples that they've drafted, whether it's believing, you know, Jesse Williams was going to be able to overcome chronic injuries that he had. They move up to take that guy. And that was one I remember, I think, everybody on the same page. Like, I don't see this guy even making the roster, much less having an impact in the league. Obviously optimistic there. Do you look at missed draft picks, whether it's all the fourth round receivers we've talked about or any other missed draft pick you want to talk about? Is that just a misevaluation based on optimism, or how do you view the failure of some of these guys?
I just view it as it being the NFL, because again, you go back and look at what I'm not sure what the hit rate is with other sports is, but just for pro football, I mean, you go back and look at anybody's draft, and like we always talk about, three or four guys are going to make it out of each draft. Every once in a while, you'll get five or six that, you know, just are really good and solid. But for the most part, you have to be that way. I'll bet you, I think it's really cool that he says that, because I think it means that he's self-aware. He knows what his, you know, what his downside is. And maybe John, you know, I think John's optimistic too. And I think most coaches are that way. You sort of need to be that way. It's funny, I mentioned that thing with Daryl Taylor when we did the breakdown on the Tennessee defensive end that the Seahawks drafted in the second round. That, you know, I saw him do something, and I'm like, okay, if he can do that, then he can repeat it. We can coach him up to be able to continue to do that on a consistent basis. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I'm glad that he talks about it, and he's probably just like every other coach. But, you know, I'll say this, if you're a player and you have a guy like that behind you, which I don't remember. Remember when we were talking to Yogi Roth? I said, I think the one head coach that I had that was probably like the most encouraging and the most like Pete Carroll was Paul Wiggin. And Pete and Paul were friends as they coached together, I think, in Minnesota. So, yeah, you don't often get that from. I mean, if Pete Carroll comes up to you, I told you guys the story about on the airplane when I was going to do radio, and he's like, "Yeah, man, you're going to do great. Go let it rip." I mean, that's the kind of stuff you don't hear from a lot of coaches. So, yeah, you're going to fail, but I feel like that's part of what makes Pete great.
Yeah, I just love hearing that. I love that whole thing that Pete has to say, these flying coach podcasts that he's doing with Steve Kerr. And I heard that Steve Kerr was in, I think Bruce Irvin told us this, that Steve Kerr was involved in one of the team meetings. And then Will Ferrell, it was a week ago or something like that. But Pete Carroll always being creative. And I love people who will admit that they're wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, if you're wrong, you're wrong. But he's wrong being optimistic, too optimistic. And, I mean, typically, I mean, you need to think about negative pessimism, that type of thing, you know. But I just, I don't know, I love hearing that. And so he sees the best in people. And, you know, guys like me, sometimes I always see the worst in people. And I appreciate that Pete Carroll is the way that he is. And the 907 bringing up a good example of a guy that probably most coaches wouldn't have stuck with as long as Pete did, and that's C.J. Procise.
Yeah, that's a very good name to drop in there if you're talking about optimism and believing and, hey, we saw that game. We saw that game against the Eagles or that game against the Patriots, and he showed flashes, so we're going to maybe stick with guys longer than you otherwise should, or you draft guys that maybe don't give you a ton on film, but you see one or two spectacular moments or games, and that becomes good enough to draft him. Cut number 9, Pete Carroll says, you know, despite some of the misses, there have been some hits, and he uses KJ and Doug Baldwin as two guys who developed after reaching the NFL.
There's a couple guys that come to mind. One was Doug Baldwin, the receiver that was had, you know, from Stanford, had a great career until it, you know, he called it off last year. And there's another guy named KJ Wright. He's a linebacker from down in Mississippi, and he was an extraordinarily different athlete, real long and tall and big stride guy, but man, he's had a great career for us. But not the most heralded player, you know, in our program, but a guy who really did some great stuff that you kind of, I was really excited about him as a player. I mean, I've got all kinds of stories about those guys, but that's a couple that come to mind.
So there's some success stories. The optimism paid off in a huge way. You could argue Doug Baldwin is the second best receiver to ever put on a Seahawks uniform behind Steve Largent.
Yeah.
No, yeah, you, I mean, look, you could, Bob.
Thought he could play in the NFL. And
go ahead. Did we lose everybody?
Did we lose Dave?
I've got a really long delay, but I think every coach has stories like this that, you know, you have to take a chance on certain guys. Look at Tony Romo. I believe he was an undrafted free agent and out of Eastern Illinois. I mean, that's a huge stretch, and he has almost every Cowboy record there is, even with, you know, Staubach and what's his face being there, Troy Aikman. So
Troy
yeah,
Aikman.
It's, I think every coach has that same. Yeah, every coach has that same, those same kinds of stories. So, but I would rather go down and be more positive than negative. Because I mean, can you imagine passing on guys like that, and then they go on, and you look at him and go, "Wow, we almost took, you know, we were going to bring that guy in here, we were going to take a shot on him, and I should have looked at the good part of it rather than the bad part." I guess I'd rather be wrong being optimistic than the other way around.
Yeah, it's fun, Dave, and I know you're going to look at some more of the undrafted free agents at 5:45 today, but you always look at those guys, and part of that's just is Pete Carroll's optimism in these guys, and we've seen it year after year after year. They always come up with a guy that they didn't draft that makes the team and becomes a factor. Puna Ford is the latest example of that. Doug Baldwin, Michael Bennett. I mean, you just go over all the years, it just seems like they find these guys, and I have to think, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Pete Carroll, who was really interested in Chris Carson, too, and getting him in the 7th round. And I don't know if that would have happened without Pete's optimism and interest in Carson at that point. So, yeah, it's a good quality to have. And I need to I need to work on a little bit of that part of Pete Carroll's game myself.
I'm sure we all could. Compared to Pete, we're all very cynical and down. I mean, he makes everybody seem sort of just depressed. He's he's bubbling over with enthusiasm. All right, coming up, a South Korean soccer team is apologizing after using dolls intended for other things than sitting in a crowd in Sunday's match. We're going to hear about that when we sweep the dial next with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Sweeping the dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
Also, to be fair to the Korean team, after you call whoever makes the mannequins for the department stores, who else is out here making things that look like people? I can't think of any other place, any other industry where full-size people dolls are in production. And I'm a little surprised, if we're going to be honest here, that the company that makes the sex dolls had inventory to spare. Because I would think times like these, I mean, have you tried to buy, like, dumbbells? You know what I'm saying? Have you tried to buy, like, an exercise bike? People bought all those up.
Yeah, like, I'm sure. Just telling you, these aren't Pelotons, Bamani.
I think they would have bought all those up.
That's Bomani Jones, Dan Le Batard, and Katie Nolan discussing a South Korean soccer club that's apologized for being accused of putting, they were putting mannequins, they were thought to be mannequins, in the empty seats during a match to simulate a crowd, but apparently they were sex dolls. So FC Seoul expressed sincere remorse over the controversy, but insisted in a statement that it used mannequins, not sex dolls, to mimic a home crowd during Sunday, the match on Sunday. Now, if that's true, what are they apologizing for?
Well, maybe they chose them because they look like they're yelling. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the reason would be.
What do you mean, what are they apologizing for?
Well, because they said that they were mannequins, that they were not sex dolls. So if they were, in fact, mannequins, why would they owe an apology?
Well, because they were not necessarily mannequins. I mean, well, they were mannequins, but they were special mannequins.
But they were saying they were not special. They were just mannequins. That's what they're saying. But then they apologized anyway.
How did people know that called them out? How do people know that they were sex dolls? How do you know what a sex doll looks like? How can you tell the difference between a sex doll and a mannequin? That's my question.
Yeah, I don't know who called them out. Is there video of this, by the way? I haven't seen the video. All I'm picturing are those old cheap dolls you see in movies that look like just an inflated balloon with a pair of red lips painted on them. It's just like a giant balloon with arms. That's what I'm picturing
Bob, it sure sounds like you and Dave know more about this subject than I do. I'm just taking my information from a New York Times story. The New York Times story said that fans noticed business logos for sex toy marketers on the clothing of said mannequins, and they also noticed strikingly buxom physiques, and there were 24 dolls in the stands, and nearly all of them were women. So that's that was another giveaway. There weren't any man mannequins.
I wonder if they were the Elaine doll, Dave. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, that could be. Also, remember Safety Man? There was Safety Man. I saw that in a movie the other day where it's like a male mannequin that you put in your seat next to you. So it looks like you have somebody with you. Or you can also, there's those ones that, where people do the carpool violation by putting mannequins in their car so they can drive in the carpool lane.
Can we go to the next item before we get called into an office somewhere?
I was the only Bulls fan in the store. I had bets, wagers, I should say, with everybody in the store on it. And so he comes over and he goes, hey, I think it's the Bulls. And he goes, I don't know why, but if I heard so-and-so correct, and I can't remember who he was speaking with, but someone that worked with the Marriott, he goes, it might be, you know, one of the players. Okay, good. I said, you know what? I had just started there about 3 or 4 weeks earlier. I'd been hired as an assistant manager. And I go, oh, well, I'm delivering it. In fact, I may have been the manager on duty. I shouldn't have left the store. I don't know. I could have gotten trouble for that. But I was like, hey, I will make the pizza. And I remember saying this. I will make the pizza because I don't want any of you doing anything to it. And I said, and then I told the driver, I said, you're going to take me there. So and I'll be nice since I'm on the radio. Since the crap story that the guy said that there were five people, there was two of us. And I didn't even have that many people working. at the time at the store, but there was only two of us. And obviously the pizza has basically never left me.
That's the voice of Craig Feit. Not sure how you pronounce his last name, but he was on with the Big Show 1280 in Utah. He's the one that delivered the pizza in question to Michael Jordan, the one that was talked about causing the food poisoning, you know, that was deemed the flu game, but they said it came from the pizza. He's sitting there saying, I was the Bulls fan. I'm not a Utah fan. I was the Bulls fan. And you heard him saying, I didn't want anybody messing with it. And it was only two people. It wasn't five people at the door. And he clearly didn't know it was going to Michael Jordan. He thought it would just be a Bulls player like we had talked about yesterday. So I'm not sure what happened to Michael. It doesn't. According to this guy, nothing was messed with, and he was going out of his way to make sure it wasn't messed with. And then the addition to this story, Dave, you sent that story that apparently Michael Jordan took this pizza when he got it and spit on it so nobody else would eat it. And that wasn't the first time he had done something like that, spitting on food. I think there was an example in the story of some cinnamon rolls he had that he spit on so nobody would eat them. So according to that story that you said, Dave, the addition to this story is not only was it delivered by a Bulls fan who wasn't certain who he was delivering it to, just thought it was a Bulls player, but also Michael took it into the room and spit on it so nobody else would eat it.
Yeah, well, it's funny. My grandpa used to do that when there would be like a box of chocolates. He would lick the top of all of them. So that way, nobody else could have any. So, yeah, I wonder. It's the same line of thinking. I'll just say this, man. I felt hearing that story that happened to me in Carolina for a playoff game when I was doing pre and post radio. I can't remember what year it was, like 14, 15, whenever we went out there, and I got sick from eating some deep fried cucumbers or something. And I'll just say this, that when I went to the stadium, I left a $100 bill for the cleaning lady because that's how bad I felt. So, yeah, that was just miserable and brutal. And I can't believe he went out and what, got 38 points that night or something?
Yeah.
$100, Dave? You left that much?
It she was underpaid, Jim. Trust me. It was brutal.
You know what, to be honest, PR, it actually was. I had no idea how long the lockout was going to be, and myself and my trainer, my man Sears, we really started to actually train to be a football player when it came to like October and November. We started to clock our times with the 40s. We started to add a little bit more in our bench presses and things of that nature. We started to add more sled into our agenda with our workouts. And, you know, Mike kept talking about, you know, it'd be great to go down to Irvine, Texas. You know, it'd be great to go to Irvine, Texas. You know, Mike is, you know, he's from Texas. Diehard Cowboy fans. You know, he's like, it'd be great to go down there to Dallas, you know, and suit it up for the Cowboys. How great that'll be.
Well, we brought this up with Clayton earlier, and apparently LeBron James back in 2011 when there was a lockout in the NBA sent a tweet or something to him asking if he thought he could play in the NFL, to which John Clayton said, well, you're tweeting me, so I believe you can play in the league. As brilliant of an athlete as LeBron is, and he's one of the greatest ever touch a basketball without question. In 2011, I believe that puts him at 9 years since he last played football as a junior in high school. Didn't even play his senior year, and then obviously didn't play college football. So the idea that he was 9 years, 8 or 9 years removed from playing football at any sort of competitive level and then was going to just hop right into the NFL. It's a tough one to believe. Maybe he could be the one freak athlete to do it, but Dave, you would know better than anybody. What do you think the chances would be?
Well, I like to think, first of all, John told him that he could, so he decided not to, but no, I'm just kidding, Clayton. yeah, I mean, look, there are some guys. I mean, look at Julius Peppers. He was really good. I felt like he could have played in the NBA, but you know, he was playing football at that time, too. And then, you know, there's Antonio Gates. So those are probably the two best examples. Maybe, you know, Jimmy Graham was a really good basketball player that turned that way. But, yeah, I'm not sure about LeBron James. He was such a huge target. Also, I mean, why would he want to do that? I mean, he's the best basketball player in the world, best one since Michael Jordan. So, yeah, he probably I'm not sure how seriously he was considering that at the time.
Yeah, well, you look at it, though, and you think about LeBron, how physically gifted he is, being 26 years old at that time, 6 foot nine, 250 pounds. I wouldn't put it past him to be a heck of a tight end in the league.
Certainly got the size. I'm just looking at the gap between the last time he played competitive football to that point, and you're talking, again, about 8 or 9 years. And I don't know. Maybe he could. Maybe he could, but we'll never know. All right, it is Tuesday. You know what that means? Every Tuesday at 5 o'clock, we bring in the one, the only El Hombre. Michael Bradley joining us next year with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.